Welcome, welcome.
A notable welcome to all you music lovers.
To
Journey.
To the stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back
your host.
Your host.
Our dad.
Brian.
Frazier.
What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
Hey everyone, and a very warm welcome to Journey to the Stage. And a big thank you to all of our listeners across Europe, and a special greeting to you. And I'm glad you've tuned in for part two of this interview with singer-songwriter Steve Wynn. I don't know if you know this or not, but there are well over 3 million podcasts in existence. That is a lot. Many of the big music interview podcasts are hosted by people that are well-known in the music world. They're artists, people with name identification. Since I'm not one of those guys, I look to listeners like you. And if you could take 30 seconds wherever you're listening to follow, to give a kind rating or subscribe, leave a nice review, it really makes such a big difference altering the algorithm and helps other people to find us. So a big thank you to all who do that. So this is part two of my interview with Steve Wynn. And if you haven't listened to part one, you should check that out first. And if you have not watched the new Dream Syndicate documentary, it is currently available on Amazon to stream and to rent and on Vimeo, and it is excellent and definitely a must watch for any Dream Syndicate fan. And lastly, Steve has just handed over his completed memoir to his publisher just days ago, and that is going to be released this fall. The memoir will be titled, I Wouldn't Say It If It Wasn't True. You'll be able to purchase that wherever you usually buy books, but you'll definitely want to get a signed copy on Steve's Bandcamp page. I will get one myself. And the link to Steve's Bandcamp page will also be down in the show notes, and you can look for that book release in August. All right, so we have got some great chat with Dream Syndicate Steve Wynn ahead of us. Let's jump back into the conversation. I'm curious, though, as a writer, because as I mentioned, you really are one of my favorite songwriters. What kind of writer would you say you are? Are you somebody who... you write for a project, I'm working with these guys, we want to record within the next 6 months or whatever, or are you kind of a writer who just is continual, daily work, sitting down, crafting and workshopping songs? Like, what kind of writer are you?
I used to be more that kind of a writer. I guess like a lot of writers, when I started out, I just was writing all the time. And I still love writing songs, but I will be honest and say, I'm most productive and most excited when I'm writing, like you say, for a project. It's like, oh, we're going to make this record with these people in this city. And I can almost imagine what that's going to be like, because I know the group, the vibe in that city, and I know where we'll be eating and how we'll be living. And I'm going to try to write songs that will fit the environment. I'm going to write the soundtrack for what's going to happen. And I kind of do that now. And I like that. I'm finishing up a solo record right now that's going to come out in August. And cool. I'm working right now on the last track, the lead off track. And I know how it's going to get the record started. I can hear it. I've already got, I'll probably finish it tonight, I hope. I'm trying to get the song done.
Nice.
But I'm hearing the song not just like, oh, here's a new song, but as this is the first thing that happens when you, quote unquote, put on the needle. I've always, well, not always, but largely been a writer who kind of visualizes the situation and then write to that situation. When I was writing the song for Days of Wine and Roses, my method, which worked pretty well, was I would imagine myself putting the needle down on a turntable onto the record and imagining what I'd want to hear when it landed. And I could do that. I could think, okay, this is my moment. This is the thrill. I just bought this new record, the needle's going down, and what's going to come out that's going to make me excited? And it would come in my head sometimes. I could actually hear, this is it. So I still kind of do that. I still go into a project thinking, well, what's missing? What's needed here? Almost like I'm sure like maybe a movie director does, where you think, okay, I need the scene that's going to hold this together. It's going to tell the story of that character. It's going to allow the whole thing to make sense. And I go into projects that way. I see the whole project. I see, like we said earlier, the idea of an album might be a dying art form or a less relevant art form, but still the one I'm drawn to. I still can't help but to hear music in terms of a 45-minute piece with a last song on side one and a first song on side two. It's just the way I'm wired. It's the way I hear things. So, you could say, for example, like Martin Scorsese, who makes, his movies get longer and longer, but he did make these great movies, that are something you sit down in the theater or in front of you on your couch and watching a whole thing. And you might say, well, geez, Marty, now the thing is to make TV shows that are 10 episodes per year for 4 seasons. And you might say, great, But my way that I view movies is something you can see in one sitting. And that's great. I guess what I'm trying to say is everybody has a different way they look at the process of what they do or what it means to them. I'm an album guy. I still am. I can't get around it.
Well, and I think the ability to tell a better and deeper story is there in an album. And I think that's one of the things, we, as we talked about earlier, we miss the experience of sitting and listening to a musical journey. You know, the songs are great. You know, singles have been around forever, but you're right. There's the TikTok aspect of this where an artist wants to get, you know, as many plays as they can. And I understand that, but we miss the experience. And usually the single then would point somebody to an album. And so, yeah, we kind of miss that now. There are still people who are making albums, thankfully, but a lot of the younger artists, it's just singles. I'll have PR people reach out to me and say, hey, would you consider having so-and-so? And I look and they've got 4 singles released. I'm like, that's not something that I could really make an episode out of. And I want to, you know, it allows for a deeper conversation when there's an album to talk about. So it is kind of different. And it'll be interesting to see where things swing and if we'll see a swing back to the longer form over time. That'll be kind of interesting.
As you well know, you know, we are, or I won't presume to know how old you are, but, you know, I think we're more or less the same generation.
Mid-50s.
Where we were all about the albums, but it wasn't that way before. That's a creation of the early 60s. I mean, before it really was like, you know, I'm cutting some new sides. I'm cutting sides over RCA for, you know, and things like that. So it just goes in, you know, it's whatever you're used to, whatever feels good to you. And I guess if I was, say, 30 years old and felt like, you know, I remember this feeling at 30 where it's like, wow, I really like doing this and I want to keep doing it, but I know that it's going to take some work, some luck, some strategizing to keep doing it. So maybe I should make sure there's one catchy song on this record. And that's where, you know, this 1990, that's where I would think. Now, doesn't matter. I'm lucky. I can do whatever. So I do have that. Yeah. I can say, you know what? I know we are in different times. I know that if I really, really wanted to hit the big time and make $1 million or have a chance to do that, I guess I should figure out this TikTok thing or I should make sure I get a song in the right TV show and take the right meetings to do that. And you know, that's great if you're into that kind of thing. I'm not. I embrace any bits of success that come along. At the same time, I don't care. I just don't care. You know, it's not relevant to, you know, all I care about is being able to keep doing it. I do keep up as well as I can, which is to say very marginally. I try to keep up on what's happening in mainstream music, and I'll try to hear new things and, like, you know, drive my wife Linda crazy and my friends crazy. Like just last week or a couple weeks ago, I got into Fred again. I kept reading about Fred again. It's like, I dig this. This is cool. It's kind of EDM techno stuff, but it's, you know, got a thing to it. And I hear the soul there. I like that. And I play for people I knew and they say, why are you listening to that crap? That's horrible. But I want to know. I always kind of know what's going on. Having said that, you know, my main exposure, I will watch the Grammy Awards most years just to see all the stuff I don't know about. That's not because that's not my world as a musician or as a fan. But I was really heartened the other when I watched a couple of days ago, and you know, Taylor Swift, of course, won the big award, the album of the year, and she said something in her acceptance speech along the lines of, "I just love what I do, and I'm glad I can keep doing it." I thought that was really refreshing. You're the biggest star of this century. And all your first thing you want to say is, I love writing my songs and making my records. And as long as I can keep doing that, I'm happy. And I believe that. I don't think that was, you know, aw shucks, false humility. I think that was probably how she feels. So it's nice to know. There's no better motivation than that. You know, you can be a talented hit maker. You can be the in-demand producer or whatever. And that's, you can also be the best car mechanic in Queens. And that's a good skill too. But if you're an artist, you should just want to make art that pleases you.
Well, I definitely see that in your career. And three things, I was thinking about this last night as I was preparing, three things that I've really, among other things that I appreciate about music you've made is there are no lyrical cliches, no musical cliches. And you kind of have this approach to music, like exactly what you said, I'm going to make what I want to make. And as I mentioned earlier, I think that's really refreshing, because you're right, there are some people who write for radio, and no knock on them, people are doing what they need to do. there's great integrity, and that's not to diminish anybody else, but in what you're doing. I think that's really, really cool. So as you moved into your solo career, I mean, you've had 14 solo albums now or so. So when you left the Dream Syndicate, when that band came to an end, what have you found maybe that as a solo artist, maybe that you didn't have in the band context? Like what's the itch you've been able to scratch maybe that you couldn't earlier on in the Dream Syndicate early days?
I guess at first that I could do anything I wanted and that I could play any kind of music I wanted with any kind of musicians to help me play that whatever kind of music that I wanted. Early on, that was the biggest change. It was like a kid in a candy store. And I was lucky to be on a label, Rhino Records, the same label from the store I'd worked at 10 years before, but on a label that would give me decent budgets to kind of follow my little fantasy land there of, oh, I'm going to hire this bass player for this song and that drummer for that song. And it was fun. That lasted really for me about 3 or 4 years of that kind of thrill of being the choreographer of my own little widescreen Busby Berkeley, Fellini, or the Ziegfeld Follies kind of productions. And I very quickly went back to just enjoying being part of a band. And even though I was being advertised, when I toured to Steve Wynn here, Steve Wynn there, there was always some core band around me. So I really, one constant, whether it be the Dream Syndicate or the Baseball Project or Gutterball or the majority of my solo years, is that I like being part of a band. I like having people to play off. Except I should point out, I tour a lot by myself, and that's a different thing entirely. That's such a night and day difference from touring with a band, and I like both things. But when I'm playing with a band, I don't really need to be, a dictator. I'm happy to kind of wait to see what happens and how we interact. And that's the fun thing for me. When I play with a band, the thrill is to be on a stage with other musicians and just sort of being in the moment and responding to what's happening and that conversation. I feel like the audience is there to witness that conversation that we're having on stage. When I play solo, I always say when I play solo acoustic or solo electric, I'm jamming with the audience. I'm actually having that same back and forth, but I'm very, very aware of the people who are there in the room with me and trying to feel each moment how we're going to connect throughout the evening and aware when it goes off the rails, where I'm losing people. And I try to, so it's the same mentality. Whatever I do, I'm got the antenna out and I'm trying to find human connection, whether it's the audience or my band members. I think that's how I've always been. I don't see what I do as this, performing monkey who just goes up there and does his shtick.
So I want to talk Baseball Project, because here in the midst of, your solo career, you put this band together. It's what's commonly known as a super group. You've got, obviously, yourself. You've got Scott. Is it pronounced McGahey?
McCoy. Unlikely, but all those letters turn into McCoy.
Yeah, I was like, where does that go? Okay, cool. And then Linda Pittman. Now, is this Linda, your wife, Linda?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought I read that somewhere, but I was like, I wasn't sure. And then you'd mention your wife, Linda. And then, of course, Steve Mills and Peter Buck from REM. So kind of talk about what drove that. Obviously, your love for collaboration. But what else kind of fed into that? And how did you guys get together and start making music?
Well, love of baseball, of course. That band began 15 years ago now. I had never met Scott McCoy before. I knew Peter and Mike well, and of course Linda was at the time my girlfriend and soon to be my wife. And REM was being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame here in New York, and they had a big party the night before they got inducted. A really lavish, pull out all the stops kind of party and nice meal and everything. Mm-hmm. And I went with Linda. And I met Scott that night, and I knew about Scott, and he knew about me, but we just never met. And we ended up standing at the bar and being the last to leave, as we have been many times since then. And we started talking about baseball, and I don't know, we got into that. And at some point, I think I said, Scott, I've always wanted to write an album about baseball. And he said, me too. Like, well, let's do it. Wow. And we wrote the songs and had we were in the studio within a few months. And Linda is a huge baseball fan. Scott is a huge baseball fan. Peter is not. Peter is a fan of literature and history and music, and appreciates baseball in ways it fits into those things. He likes, say, books about baseball, but he's not a sports guy at all. But he's Scott's constant musical partner and likes me and Linda, so we put this band together. Eventually, we expand to a five-piece with Mike, who's also a gigantic baseball fan. So I would say the main motivation for that band to make records and go on tour is just that we like each other so much. It's like if we book a baseball project tour, I know I get to hang out with Scott and Peter and Mike for a month, and that'll be fun. And then whatever else happens is gravy. So it's a very pure motivation with that band. I think we like the subject matter, we like the company, and we like that it makes people happy. And we occasionally, you know, for all the bands we've been in over the years, big bands like REM, of course, modestly sized bands like the Dream Syndicate. And we've all played festivals to 50,000 people one time or another, some more than others. We've all, you know, been on this TV show or that, had plenty of rock and roll thrills over the years. But the thing which we get to do with this band that we never got to do otherwise is we go to ball games and we're on the field. Like, you know, we're walking around there singing the national anthem or throwing out the first pitch or hanging out in the dugout. And like, that's a whole different world for us. So I think we get brand new rock and roll jollies from being in that band and meeting ball players here and there and stuff like that. It's fun.
Rock and roll jollies. That could actually be a good album title.
It would be. Or book.
Yeah. Well, that's really neat. That's pretty unique that a musical group is driven by friendship. We like each other, and therefore we get together to make music. That's kind of unique. It's usually the other way around. We make music together and then become friends. But I think that's kind of refreshing.
Or so get together, that's become so friends, cool. And then become mortal enemies, and then break up.
Yeah, no, I've talked to artists who, you know, were part of bands that none of the members could talk to each other, literally. Yeah. They never talked with each other. In 2017, Dream Syndicate, you guys put out How Did I Find Myself? It's almost 30 years after Ghost Stories.
I know.
You know, you talked about you guys did play together some after that kind of initial split, but what prompted the desire to kind of blow the dust off of that and make some new music together?
There was never really a plan to do that, and I kind of steadfastly avoided that because I was doing other things and having fun. The real answer is in 2012, I was asked to play a festival in Spain. It was one Bilbao, Spain, and it was one I really wanted to do. And at that time, both the baseball project and my solo band, the Miracle Three, were both busy, and I wanted to play the festival, and I just spontaneously said to the promoter, "What about the Dream Syndicate?" The guy kind of laughed, and he said, "Well, are you serious?" I said, "Maybe." And so I kind of, that became the starting point. And I reached out to Mark Walton and Dennis Duck, the rhythm section back then. And they both said, "Sure." And I reached out to Paul Cutler, who had been the last guitarist. And he was still very much a friend, but he didn't want to do it. I think he didn't like the idea of doing going back, you know, doing something nostalgic. He also, I think, felt that he couldn't play the way he did back then, which I think was nonsense. But I said, "Well, I do want to do this." And, you know, the obvious choice for a guitarist would be Jason Victor, who had played with me in my solo band for the previous decade, who's a fantastic guitarist, who came from the total school of where we came from, who was, you know, kind of a very talented and schooled guitarist, but also not afraid of anarchy and noise and, you know, and like, you know, who likes Bad Brains as much as he likes Rush, you know, and it all fits into his whole aesthetic, you know, and he was a perfect fit. And we went out to play this festival and then another four shows in Spain, and people loved it. Like we didn't know, we didn't know, hey, maybe we'll do this. No one will care, but we'll have a fun vacation in Spain. People responded really well. So next thing I know, we're being offered shows all over the place, and we kept playing. Okay, we're going to Germany now. Now we're going to England. Now we're going to Norway. Oh, time to play the States now. We started hitting all the cities we used to play and had a ball.
Wow.
People were so happy. You'd see people smiling in the audience, just like whether they were people from our generation who thought, "I'd never see this band again," or younger people said, "I'd missed them the first time around, and now here I am." It was really gratifying to be on stage and see such happy people and have so much fun.
Yeah.
But after about 4 or 5 years of this, of the oldies band Gravy Train that we were having and having a ball with that, we kind of all felt like, well, we've played New York 3 times and London 3 times and Madrid 3 times, and people were liking it. But man, if we want to keep this going, we'd better come up with something new to say, because, you know, if I don't, you know, want to be out there being the coasters or the drifters and playing, you know, up on the roof for the right. thousandth time. Not there's anything wrong with that, but we just didn't want to be that kind of a band.
Sure.
So we decided, you know what, let's go into the studio. Let's make a new record. If it's good, we'll put it out and we'll see what happens. If it's bad, nobody will ever know. We paid for it ourselves. We had a self-financed recording session because we didn't announce it or put it in random notes in Rolling Stone, that kind of thing. We just kind of said, let's see what happens. And we were kind of shocked that it went so well. The record you heard first by us.
We
made that in five.
It's a
made it
wonderful
five day.
Album.
We just clicked. It was like this. It was a sound of a band that honestly liked playing together, that had played a lot of shows together at that point, and was ready to prove something. And I think we went into that session saying, okay, let's justify this band's existence. And we did a pretty good job. And here we are, 7 years later.
Yeah, and I could not love that album more. It is a favorite album of mine. I thought this would be a great place for those who aren't familiar with the music of the Dream Syndicate to play the song that I first heard and just helped me fall in love with the band. This is Filter Me Through You from their comeback album, How Did I Find Myself Here?
Filter me through you.
So writing wise, did you do the bulk of the writing? Were you writing on the road, or did you get off the road and write for a while? Like, what was that kind of led up to you guys going into the studio?
It's like we were talking about before, writing for a project. And I wrote for this idea of what I thought the band was at that point. I certainly didn't overthink it or put pressure myself, but I wanted a record that would have some connection to who we'd been before, that would fit into the previous, that didn't come out. Like, you know, there have been a lot of bands, I don't know a lot, but there have been bands who reunited and made new albums under their old name. It sounded nothing like the band at all. And you think, well, why did you bother doing that?
Right.
And the flip side is bands who reunite and make carbon copies of what they used to be and think, well, it's kind of like it used to be, but not quite as good. I wanted to thread that needle and make a record that felt like a Dream Syndicate record and yet hinted something new. And one thing I really like about the reception to that record, besides the fact that people liked it, is the most popular song on that record, if you look at audience reaction at shows or things like Spotify or whatever, reviews and all that, was the title track, an 11-minute song that was radically different every time we played it. I mean, I'd written the basic bulk of the song, you know, the chord changes, the words ahead of the session, but I knew I wanted it to be a long song, and we just played it every day in the studio, different ways every time, and chose our favorite version. And it was, you know, all kinds of very different takes on the same song. My musical obsession at that time was the Byrds live versions of 8 Miles High. They were playing in the late 60s after, you know, Crosby and Chris Hillman were gone at that point, when they kind of were playing with Clarence White and Skip Adden. They would play these 20-minute versions of 8 Miles High, where the first 15 minutes would be a jam and we would break into the song. I went, this is such a great way of doing things. Like, just, you know, it's like what jazz guys do, but like, let's go in and see how long we can stretch it out before the song starts. And it was the way that song was. It was like it's a challenge to ourselves to, yeah, it was a song with hooks and melody, but don't make it a pop song. Mm-hmm. Just let it be, you know, this free form. I always hate to say jazz kind of thing, because that's pretentious and we're not a jazz band, but at the same time, it was with that kind of an attitude. And unlike in the 80s, we now had some amount of the chops to pull it off. I think a song like that back then might not have worked as well, but we were better. We were a better band, and we pulled it off.
Oh, how fun. So as I was preparing last night, this was cool. I get this notification on my phone that the new Dream Syndicate album has been uploaded for me. And I'm like, wait, what is this? And so the live album. And so that's what I sat listening to as I was kind of working on our chat together here. But I was debating on the title. Is it Live Through the Past Darkly, or is it Live Through the Past Darkly? Or have you left it kind of intentionally open to interpretation?
Yeah, for the latter. And it can be either. And, you know, of course, a little nod to the Rolling Stones compilation of the 60s as well. All of our reissues, archival projects of the last 5 years, the Days of Wine and Roses box set, the Out of the Gray box set, and now this collection, had been put together by Pat Thomas, who Pat is a kind of our quasi-manager. He calls himself our facilititator. He is our A&R man for our label, Fire Records. He also is a well-known book writer. He's written books about Allen Ginsberg and Jerry Rubin and other and Lou Reed and other things. He also is a musician himself. He kind of handles the archival projects, and I generally give him a free rein on naming them, and he goes for pretty wild names. So that's all Pat's handiwork. And I've never asked him which one it is, but I think the idea is it could go both ways. But this is just this is essentially it's the soundtrack to the documentary about the band that came out last year. It's just a material. So it spans the entire history of the band, from the earliest lineup with Kendra, through Paul, through Jason, through, you know, having Chris Kakavas in the band, kind of as a good snapshot of the live band we've been over the years. Yeah, it's streaming now everywhere, but it also comes with the DVD of the documentary that is coming out, I think, this month sometime. And it's a good documentary. I got to say, I can say it's wonderful, it's great art, because we didn't make it. Yeah, it's just about us. And the guy who made it, this Dutch guy named Emil Spolder, has been working on it for 10 years and put his life's blood, his time, his money, his everything into making this thing, which was very flattering that he would do that. And he did a great job at telling the story.
I'm looking forward to checking that out. And you're right, that album, it covers, well, there's a 40-year span on it. You've got songs from 83, and then you've got songs from 2023. And, you know, especially those, the early tracks, it just shows really the raw power of the band. And man, it is really cool. It's a really neat album. As I mentioned, I was listening to it last night, and you guys were pretty blistering, particularly in those early days. Man, you guys just went for it live. I'm like, wow, this is some powerhouse rock right here. You guys,
we were fearless. Tore it up. To our advantage and sometimes to our disadvantage, we were a fearless band. We just didn't, you know. I remember we played right after Days of Wine Roses came out, when we were kind of like starting to really connect with people. We played a sold out show at the Roxy, the kind of showcase nice. Theater in LA. And we went and played that show. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was my mood or our mood that night, or the fact that we knew people were paying attention, or what it was. We played probably the only safe set we had played up to that point. We would take great pleasure in whatever the audience wanted. We would do the opposite. If we thought they wanted to hear, we were bratty. We were antagonistic. We were contrarians. We were trying. We thought testing our audience was a badge of honor. And that one show we played, I remember at the Roxy, we played it so straight, and it was probably a very good show. People liked it, and it was probably a very, but I remember walking off stage and feeling miserable because I thought we had sold out, which of course we hadn't. We were still playing music
right.
55 degrees to the left of mainstream at the time. But to me, it's like, no, this is not who we are. And that goes back to what you're saying about the early material, the early live performances. When we played back in those days, we just wanted to challenge our audience and ourselves and really push limits and had no fear of anything, no fear of pissing off the audience, no fear of losing fans. We just figured we're going to do this thing each night, and you're along for the ride or not. And if you're not, then we don't want to have you anyway. It's a bratty thing to say, that's how we felt at the time. So that came out when I look back on listen back on these live recordings back then. I think, wow, we were pretty good. And I think what was good about us was, for what we lacked maybe in experience and talent, you know, we were not bad players, but not well seasoned. For what we lacked in that, we had an attitude to burn.
I hope people will go and listen to it, because it's an album. It's recorded, I think there's a song recorded in Japan or something on that. Like, it's really, it spans quite a swath of the world. So that's super cool. So as we get close to the end of our time, so new projects, you've got the live album that just dropped. You're working on a new solo album, and the documentary's coming out soon. So you've got, lots of irons and lots of fires. It's cool. And I'll make sure we'll link all those things so people can keep up with what you're doing.
Please do. Yeah.
Stuff like that. Is there anything else that you're working on that you want to plug at the moment?
Well, the main thing I'm working on right now that our conversation has gave me a much needed break from for the day is I'm writing my memoir, an autobiography that's going to come out in August. Oh. It's almost finished, due in 2 weeks, and coming out in the UK on a publisher, a press called a Jawbone Press, great company, and they're putting it out. And at the same time that comes out in August will be my new solo album. So that's going to be, it's going to be nice because I was making solo records regularly throughout the decades before. And when the Baseball Project and the Reunited Dreams thing started happening, I stopped doing solo records. I just kind of was so busy with the other stuff. So it's nice to kind of be getting back into that now and getting that going again too. So trying to keep all those things going and more, and just, it's never a bummer or a burden to make music. It's what I enjoy doing. So the more things, the merrier, just if things come along. If I go down to a club tonight and meet somebody who I've never met before, who's a cool keyboard player, who's doing music I admire, want to check out, and we say tomorrow let's go jam and write some songs, that could be the next thing. Just keep busy until you can't do it anymore.
Am I right, Steve, in saying that you have not at all lost the love for what you're doing? You've been doing this for many decades. It seems to me you still love it as much as you did when you were that teenager taking the stage, or that 19, 20-year-old, 21-year-old forming the Dream Syndicate. Is that love, that fire still within you, it seems like?
Yeah. And the biggest difference is I think I saw the love for it and the fire for it, but I enjoy it more now. And that's a nice thing. And that's the gravy on top, is now I get to just do it and have fun with it and not agonize over what it all means. what it all means is whatever it means that day.
I love that answer. So before we wrap up, I want to do something that I've started to do with more and more artists, and that's do some kind of quick hit questions. I call it 8 questions in 80 seconds. So I'm going to put 80 seconds on the board, and these are questions I'll ask you. You can't overthink them. You just got to tell me the first thing that comes to mind for you.
Love it.
All right, you ready?
Yeah.
All right, 80 seconds. Here we go. So what artist, living or dead, would you most want to take the stage with?
Miles Davis.
Wow. Oh, I like that. What is an album you never get tired of?
Marquee Moon by Television.
House is on fire. What's the one instrument you're grabbing on your way out?
That's a great question. Probably my old Telecaster I've hadn't played since the earliest days of the Dream Syndicate.
I know that Telecaster you're talking about, yeah.
Sunburst Tele, I love that one.
Yeah. What might fans of your music be most surprised to find in your music collection?
Probably not surprising because I talk about it so much, but the Lana Del Rey records, especially Norman fucking Rockwell, which I think is my favorite record of the last 20 years.
What a voice that young lady has. Yeah. My
great writer,
goodness.
Great writer.
That's interesting. Yeah. All right. What songwriter would you most want to write a song with?
That's a good one.
Could be living or dead.
Dr. Dre.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, man, you give great answers. I like this. All right. Who is your favorite film director?
Now you get into tough stuff because I have so many. I'm just a film fanatic. I got to say probably Scorsese, who I mentioned earlier, but there's so many I really like. Oh, yeah. And also mentioned earlier the Coen brothers. You said once, I'll say Scorsese.
I like that. It's a pretty interesting bookends there. I like that. Mm. All right. What do you do when you're on the road to help pass time?
Eat.
Okay.
One of my favorite joys of touring and traveling is discovering food. So I hunt down interesting food all along the way.
Nice. I like that. And you look for more like the local type of place.
Yeah. I'll check out, say, what is the place here, the food here, the thing that mainly exists here, and I find it and track it down.
Well, and that lends itself perfectly to our last question. What is your favorite meal?
Push come to shove, I'm an Angelino, I'm an LA kid, Mexican food. You know, that's, you know, the go-to. I like everything, but that's the go-to.
I like that. Well, here's what's interesting. So I mentioned before we were recording, my family and I were in New York a couple of Thanksgivings ago, and I had some of the best tacos I've ever had in New York. And I don't remember the name of the place, but this place was incredible.
You're killing me here.
Yes. Well, it was a place you walk in, they make your tortillas to order, which in and of itself, it's so everything is fresh there that you tell them what you want. Yeah, I want 3, you know, chicken tacos. They've got the lady over there. She's got them all balled out. She flattens them out, puts them on, cooks up your tortillas, hands them over to the guy who fills them up, and they hand them to you at the end of the counter. It is, I'll have to find the name for it, and I'll send you an email. Really, really good tacos.
I would love to know. Maybe I've been there, maybe not, but I definitely want to know. Well, next time you're in New York, come and visit me in Jackson Heights, because it's the food mecca of New York City, this neighborhood. And
really?
Yeah, you ask any foodie, they'll tell you. This is where it's the where I live here in Jackson Heights. It's the most ethnically diverse neighborhood in the world. 175 languages spoken in a neighborhood of 70,000 people. So, that's a lot. And besides the obviously joy in the cultural diversity of the neighborhood, the food is incredible. So it's no surprise that Wyndon and I live in the foodie neighborhood for the city when we enjoy it.
Oh, that's awesome. I would love to check that out. Hopefully I'll be able to get back to New York one of these days. I am so incredibly appreciative of your time. You've been very generous with your time today. I have enjoyed our conversation immensely, and I just want to say thank you for hanging out and sharing a little bit of your journey with me.
It was a blast. It was good talking to you. Steven spoke highly of you, so I was looking forward to it.
Yeah, he's such a neat guy, and I was grateful to be able to have him as a guest too. And and thank you everybody for listening. And if you've enjoyed this thoughtful and insightful conversation, share it with your friends, subscribe or follow, leave a rating. Those things are always helpful and very, very encouraging. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram at Journey to the Stage Podcast, and you can find us on YouTube as well. So links to those will all be in the show notes. So make sure you tune in next time when we walk stretch of road with another artist. And until then, keep your bags packed and join us on our next journey to the stage. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a wrap.